Campus FM presents a talk organized by the CERN entitled Religion, Conflict and Violence in Contemporary and Historical Perspective. This talk is delivered by Professor Kevin Avruk.
Your Excellency, Reverend Gentlemen, Ladies and Gentlemen, it is my pleasure this evening to introduce this lecture, or better, the lecture rather than the lecture, Professor Kevin Avruk, who is an old friend of mine, one of the oldest American friends I have. Professor Avruk has been appointed to the chair of Henry Hart Rice Professor of Conflict Resolution at George Mason University. And he's also professor of anthropology at George Mason University. He studied at Chicago University, and then he's got his MA and PhD from the University of California, San Diego, where he used to teach also. From there, since 1980, he's been teaching at George Mason University and at what used to be called ICAR, the Institute of Conflict Resolution, Analysis and Resolution, and now it has changed its name to a very strange acronym, which is almost SCAR, not to be SCAR, I mean, a School of Conflict Resolution and Analysis. He has published several books, amongst them critical essays on Israeli society, religion and government, culture and conflict resolution. I'm sure he has published another on the assimilation of immigrants, of which I have a copy at home, but it's not written here. Tonight he is going to speak to us about religion, conflict and violence in contemporary and historical perspective. We are all aware of the problems being created not by religions, but by different interpretations of religions, or perhaps by the emotions created by religions rather than by the doctrines created by religions. So without much ado, I introduce you, Professor Avruk.
Thank you, Father Joe. I was last in Malta 17 years ago in 1994, so it's been a very long time. It's wonderful to be back. And when I look around, I see some changes and some things have remained the same. The roads are much better. The traffic is much worse. The driving etiquette is about the same. And I see that you have a new national bird, the crane, which you didn't have before. Father Joe asked me to talk about conflict violence in both contemporary and historical perspective, and I'll take that seriously. So there'll be some history, some very old history in the talk tonight, and some contemporary observations as well. This is both the easiest topic to talk about and the hardest topic. It's the easiest topic because, in a way, one can simply list throughout history the amount of conflict, the amount of violence that has taken place in the name of religion in all parts of the world. And to list all of those things, either in Europe or in the Near East or in the New World, just to list all of the violence and all of the conflict perpetrated in the name of religion would really be a full lecture. But I don't want to take the easy way out for two reasons. One is I want to give some analysis, some sense of how the violence comes out of the conflict. So I'll actually be speaking more about conflict than about violence, since conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. It's the way any kind of social change happens, constructive social change. And in a way, violence is when conflict goes wrong. When conflict becomes a pathology, then one can speak about violence. So I want to speak more generally about conflict, with violence, alas, always hovering in the background. The other reason not to take the easy way out and just to speak about forms of conflict and violence is that religion has always presented two faces. The great American Catholic historian Scott Appleby, who was involved in the epic fundamentalist project that he and the historian of religion, Martin Marty, put together, argued that there is an ambivalence to the sacred. that's the title of his book, The Ambivalence of the Sacred. That on the one hand, the sacred can sanction, can justify, can rationalize violence. And on the other hand, the sacred has the strongest resources in the world for the control of violence. And that's the ambivalence. And I'll talk a little bit about that as well. I want to begin by offering three views of how religion connects to conflict from three different perspectives. One is the perspective of the sociologist. The other is the perspective of the historian of religion. And the third is the perspective of at least some philosophers of religion. So from the perspective of the sociologist, simply looking at religion as a social phenomenon and a psychological phenomenon, not really asking about faith per se, but looking at the functions of religion in society, religion is connected to conflict because it forms for so many people the inner core of their personal identity. It is what, for so many people, constitutes a sense of self. And therefore, because what social identity teaches us, social psychologists say, senses of self, senses of us, always exist with an image of the other, an image of them. If we are us, they are them. If we are we, they are they. And so anything that can create a powerful sense of us, almost by definition, ends up creating a powerful sense of them. And for that reason, the social psychologist would say it is impossible to talk about religion as a source of personal identity without also talking about it as a source of social conflict. The social scientist would also point out that religion is a powerful way of forming groups. It's a powerful way of giving boundaries to groups. We eat pork and you don't. We circumcise and you don't. We will eat beef and you won't. All of the ways in which religious symbolism can be used to create borders. And all of the ways in which religious symbolism can be used to legitimize authority, create leadership, socialize new members. All of the classic sociological functions that might be accomplished by a political party, might be accomplished by ideology, might be accomplished by kinship. But in the history of the world, religion is a very ancient way of forming social groups, and a very powerful one. If you think about modern political ideologies, whether democracy or socialism, communism, whatever, those are all products of the modern age. But religion as a way of forming groups is very, very old. So that would be the social scientist looking at religion. The historian looking at religion would see religious development through time. And the historian would say any religion, and all religion, is characterized by conflict. From the perspective of a believer standing in one place in history, religion, his or her religion, seems absolute. And then there are the others. But if one is a historian and steps back in time, what one sees is religions developing. Religions develop by two ways. Religions fission, they split apart. So there are reforms, there are counter-reforms, there are schisms, there are heresies. Most schisms and most heresies in the course of history are resolved or disappear, but some remain. And the ones that remain often themselves become regarded as new religions. So the history of religion to the historian of religion would look like a tree with a root and branches that ramify. And at the end of each branch, there is some group of individuals who believe that on that branch and with those leaves, the truth has been found. Religions also develop through fusion, not through fission, but through coming together, through syncretisms. And one can point in the world to various religions that are obviously combinations of different religions. The Sikh religion is a combination of Islam and Hinduism. Baha'i as well, a combination of Islam and Hinduism. The Druze religion of Lebanon is a combination of Shia Islam and actually Eastern Gnostic religious beliefs. So one can see religion both as fissioning through time and occasionally as fusing through time. But all of those branching offs involve, at the time in which they happen, tremendous conflict and often violence. Indeed, that's where you're likely to find violence. It's the point at which a fusion occurs or the point at which a fission occurs. Heresies are never welcomed. They're always challenged. And the challenge will often involve violence. There's a third way of looking at religion that in a way puts violence at its center, but in an ambivalent way. The philosopher René Girard studied what he called the violence of the sacred. And for him, religion, indeed all human culture, begins with the practice of sacrifice. That is the origin of human culture and the origin of human religions. And one can see in the development of the world how sacrifice gets understood differently. In some religions, in the old religions of Central America, Mexico and Central America, in the Aztec religion, the belief was that there were many gods and they nurtured the earth. They nurtured the planet. They brought the rains. They brought the seasons. But it was a transaction. And in return, the gods demanded nourishment as well. And the Aztecs believed that the nourishment that the gods demanded was blood. And so the central rituals of the Aztec world, as I'm sure most of you know, involved vast military campaigns to acquire captives that would then be ritually sacrificed to Tetzalcoatl and the great gods. And indeed, that's one of the reasons why a small band of Spaniards, Cortes, was able to overthrow a great empire, because by the time he came, all of the peoples, all of the Indians around the Aztecs had lived for decades in the shadow of ritual sacrifice. In the Old Testament, of course, one of the central stories is Abraham and Isaac and the near sacrifice of Isaac, what is called in Hebrew the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. And of course, the replacement at the last moment, because this was the beginning of monotheism and one did not ritually sacrifice humans, the substitution at the last moment of the ram. And then, of course, in the New Testament, that notion of sacrifice becomes Agnus Dei, the Lamb of God, and we come to that one sacrifice for all of mankind. Now, what all of these understandings of religion have in common, whether the social science, the historical, the philosophical, is that all of them recognize that religion is connected to power and to authority. Indeed, the word Islam means submission, submission to Allah. So there's this understanding that religion is about power, and religion gains its power from the devotion of the believers, and in turn bestows upon the believers a power, many powers, the powers to make sense of their world, the powers to imagine an afterlife. When religion gets connected to power, and when religion gets connected to authority, then it also gets connected to what we understand as politics. Because politics is also about power. It's also about authority. It's also about legitimacy. And in modern days, it gets connected to the state. Now, different religions have different orientations towards power, and indeed towards the state. The most obvious one that we speak of today is Islam, where there was never a schism between the power of the religion and the power of governance, the power to govern. And indeed, the word in Arabic for religion is not from the Latin religio, to bind, but it's the old Semitic word din, which means law. So religion is law, and law is how one governs. So in Islam, there is still thought to be a natural connection between religious power and political power, and Muslims and the world deals with that connection today. In the case of Christianity, one can view much of Western history as the struggle between religious power and the growth of state power. Much of Western history has been the history of the disconnection of the church from formal state power. In the French Revolution, this was done with tremendous violence. In Vatican II, it was done without violence. Among all of the reforms, the changes of Vatican II, the language of the Mass, a sense of tolerance and plurality, it also imagined a new connection to the state. A very fateful change in how the church related to the state. It was fateful in Latin America, in Argentina, in Chile, in places where the church was identified with the juntas, with the rulers, with the colonels. And out of Vatican II came a different conception of the role the church should play. One of the other results of that was the formation of base communities, Christian base communities, disconnected from power structures. Very important in Central America, in Nicaragua, in Salvador. Very important in the Philippines, in the struggle against Marcos. So one can imagine a violent disconnect of religion, the church in this case, with the state. One can imagine a nonviolent one. To say that it was nonviolent, of course, is not to say that it's not controversial, and the conflict around some of those reforms, of course, is still going on. When one thinks about the connection between religion and power, religion and state, one can approach it in two ways. And this is really the central concept that I want to organize my talk around tonight. One can think about something called religious politics, and one can think about something called political religion. So let me speak about religious politics first. Religious politics comes in two senses. One is a very ordinary sense. One is the sense that any institution will have its own internal politics. One can talk about the politics of the curia, the politics of the church. One can talk about university politics. One can talk about the politics in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. One can talk about the politics of a firm. That's a very ordinary sense of politics, and it is a sense of politics that exists whenever humans come together in some institution with some sets of goals or resources, and they're in competition. Competition for influence, competition for authority, competition for who gets to postulate policy, and so on. And there's no wrong or right with religious politics, except that insofar as it resembles all other politics, sometimes individuals who might expect clerics to behave better are a little surprised to find that within the institution, politics goes on just like within their university department. For some, that's a little disconcerting, but mostly when one is a grown-up, one understands that that happens. There's a second sense of religious politics, which is a little grander. And that's a sense of religious politics that happens in a democracy, usually, when there is in existence one or two specifically religious parties. In Europe, they tend to call themselves Christian Democratic parties. And in a sense, these are parties that represent the nonviolent residue of the disconnection between religion and the state. In the sense of religious politics as party politics, the religious parties will act in perfectly acceptable ways. That is, they will do what every political party does. They will seek to represent the interests of the members. They will seek to represent the interest of the institution. They will seek to function in a parliamentary democracy. They will form coalitions. They will look for votes. They will bestow patronage. They will in many ways resemble every other political party on the left or on the right. And in many European democracies, this has become an accepted and acceptable way in which religion connects democratically to politics. So that's religious politics in a small scale and in a larger scale. In the larger scale, religious politics attempts to function within the state, to protect the interests that it holds dear. Political religion is something else. Political religion occurs when a religion tries to capture the state, when a religion tries to become the state, when a religion tries to absorb all of the state functions of governance and law into its own realm of authority. It seeks to govern and not to co-govern. Once again, as an example, Islam comes to mind. First of all, the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which established the Islamic Republic of Iran. Truly, Islam is a political religion, capturing the state entirely and extruding all other elements. In fact, the elements that helped the Ayatollah come to party, extruding the more moderate students, extruding the socialist left, extruding university intellectuals who did not want to live in that sort of state. That too is a period of violence. When a political religion achieves its goals, it always does so with tremendous turbulence and tremendous violence. In the world, that's Shia Islam. In the world of Sunni Islam, one could point to the undoubted influence over the Saudi state that Salafist Islam, that Wahhabi Islam possesses. So one can see this again most clearly in the world of Islam. And in Christianity, as I said, one has a long history in which the state and the church were disconnected. But even from the beginning, one has an ambivalence. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Render unto God what is God's. Except, of course, when the Emperor Constantine converted and made Christianity the state religion, it was hard to resist also becoming what was Caesar's. But I want to give an example, not of Islam or not of Christianity. One could do the same with Buddhism in Sri Lanka or with nationalist Hinduism in India. But I want to stick with the Abrahamic religions, with the great three monotheistic religions. And I want the example to give you this evening to be one that perhaps you're less familiar with, but one which is interesting because the change, the transformation occurred in our lifetime. And that's the example of the oldest of the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, and the transformation that occurred with the coming of the State of Israel in 1948. But in order to do that, a little bit of history. This is a history part of my talk. In 70 AD, after a revolt by Jews against the Roman occupation, a revolt that had the support of many, many charismatic rabbis, so it was in its own sense a jihad. After the revolt was put down decisively by the Rome, since in 70 AD, who could successfully revolt against Rome? And the emperor dispersed the people, put down the revolt, murdered the leaders, destroyed the temple, the second temple, which had been the center of Judaism. As you know from the Gospels, Judaism was a political religion. It had a priestly caste. It was connected to the land. It was built around sacrifice, of course. That's what all of the major holidays were about, coming to the temple, doing a pilgrimage, and sacrificing. And after 70 AD, Judaism as a political religion is over. And if one looked at history and one looked at what happened to small peoples after destruction by the Roman Empire, the Scythians, start naming them, they disappear from history. But the Jews did not disappear from history, having lost a disastrous war, having lost their center, their axis mundi, Jerusalem, Zion. One of the rabbis who had not supported the uprising militarily, who thought it was a mistake, went before the emperor as a supplicant and asked for one thing from the victorious emperor. And what he asked for was the city of Yavne and its scholars. Yavne was a very small town in Palestine, but it was a town that was renowned for its rabbis, for its Jewish scholarship. And so what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said was, let us keep our scholars alive. Don't sack this town, and don't put to the sword those scholars. And emperors, having very little to fear from scholars, agreed. So for the next two millennia, Judaism changed by necessity from a political religion to a religion that existed in other settings, whether Christian settings, whether Muslim settings, and it existed and survived by drawing unto itself. It was not just pacifist, it was passive. The metaphor that the rabbis used was to draw a wall around the Torah. And by the Torah, they meant the entire religious edifice, everything, all the rabbinical literature that followed. And that wall around the Torah would protect the Torah from outside, and it would protect those inside from outside. And that indeed is how this tiny religion survived. It never challenged state power, not that it could, it just wanted to survive at times. But it survived by disconnecting itself after the disastrous revolt of 70 AD, disconnecting itself from any pretensions to state power. Well, of course, now we can move from ancient history to more modern history. The nationalist movement arises, Zionism. Zion is the old biblical term for Jerusalem, for the Holy Land. And in 1948, Israel comes into existence. Now, there were actually three variations of Judaism at this time. And I mean Orthodox Judaism. I don't mean Reform. I mean Orthodox Judaism, what some might call fundamentalist Judaism. There was one, in many ways, the most Orthodox. They call themselves the ultra-Orthodox, the fearful ones, fearful of God, were completely anti-Zionist. They did not want humans to set up a Jewish state. And the reason they were was because with the belief in the coming of the Messiah, the belief was that only the Messiah would set up a third Jewish commonwealth, would ingather the exiles. That was a divine prerogative. And therefore the attempts of humans to set up this state was an act of idolatry. It was forcing the hand of God, as they said. And so these Jews, very, very Orthodox, were and are completely opposed to the state. They do not regard, they live in Jerusalem and in other places, they do not regard the state of Israel as a legitimate entity. They, in fact, regard it as an affront. There was another strain of Orthodox Jews who did not give to the state full religious legitimacy, but understood, particularly after the Holocaust, that maybe having a place where Jews could flee, Jews could come, Jews would be welcomed, was not a bad thing. And so they became, at the founding of the State of Israel, a political party. There were several, but they became religious parties. And they worked pragmatically within the state. They were, if I could use this word, agnostic about the sacredness of the state. But they knew, as long as they were in the state, they had to protect the interests of Judaism. And so they did. And so they functioned like a political party in the Israeli parliament. And from the very beginning, in 1948, there were things called the status quo agreement that the first government of Israel agreed to. And they were faithful agreements. Some of them were things like state support of religious schools. Some of them were things that like automatic exemptions from military service for religious boys. Boys going to religious schools, automatic exemptions. Some of them were less faithful, like not having intercity bus traffic on the Jewish Sabbath. And of course, some of them involved personal status law, marriage and divorce, keeping that. And so throughout many, many decades, from 1948 basically to 1967, for two decades, these parties functioned in the arena of religious politics. And because of the nature of coalition politics in a parliamentary democracy, there were times when they had leverage because their support was needed in a coalition, and there were times when they had less leverage. When they had less leverage, they protected what they had gained. When they had more leverage, they sought to increase the reach of Judaism, the reach of the religion in the state. That was religious politics. In 1967, something changed. What changed, of course, after the Six-Day War, was that Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, biblical Israel, was now made part of the state. And, of course, city of Jerusalem, holy city of Jerusalem, was captured and made part of the state. At around this time, from teachings in different religious centers, the Yavnas of that day, but with a very different message, came this notion that how could Israel have triumphed in 1967? It must have been God's will. And if it was God's will, then maybe this is the beginning of the Messianic Age. Maybe this is a sign, the regaining of Jerusalem. What could be a more powerful sign than that? The Western Wall. And so there arose, for the first time, not anti-Zionist Orthodox and not pragmatic Orthodox, but really nationalist religious people. Young people who combine a fierce sense of political nationalism for the State of Israel with a very powerful religious vision. And that was a vision that this was the beginning of the Messianic Age. And that is, in fact, when what became settlement on the West Bank, which bedevils the peace process today, begins. Then came 1973. And in 1973, as you know, the war started very, very badly for Israel. And it was then a miracle, in their view, that Israel eventually triumphed, which is to say its survival was guaranteed. But for those young men and those young women, 1973, the so-called Yom Kippur War, was another sign from God. And it was a sign from God that said, you aren't going fast enough. And so after 1973, the apotheosis of the land was once again claimed as the center of Judaism. And of course, this is seen today mostly in the settlement movement on the West Bank in biblical Judea and Samaria. Now, these nationalists, these religious nationalists, are fiercely patriotic to the state. But they're patriotic to a state when they think the state is forwarding their program. If the state should, in their eyes, oppose their program, then they would regard the state as illegitimate, and in fact is acting against the will of God. And one should remember that Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by a young religious student for the Oslo Accords, for making peace with Yasser Arafat. And this, in a way, is what Israel faces today when it thinks about withdrawal from the West Bank, regardless of this pressure or that pressure, regardless of justice for the Palestinians. It faces this other view of Judaism, which is new. So in the years between 1948 and 2011, Judaism has moved from a situation of religious politics to being a political religion. And as one Israeli sociologist said, it appears as if the Israelis have become the Israelites. There's a kind of irony here, of course, and the irony is that now Israel faces in much of the Arab world, but particularly with Palestinians, the same symmetrical view. That is, once Hamas triumphed over Fatah, it was not a nationalist view of a Palestinian future, but it was a religious view. And so now what one faces is an Israeli religious certainty in truth and a Muslim certainty in truth, and that is perhaps the worst prescription one could write for the Middle East peace process. Let me say one thing as a footnote, and that is there is a kind of irony here. And the irony, of course, is that if a political religion succeeds in capturing a state, as Shia Islam did in Iran in 1979, if it succeeds, then it ends up by having to engage in banal and squalid religious politics. Political religions always promise much. Indeed, they promise the end of times often. But gaining control of a state, they then have to govern. And so in 1979, for many Muslims, particularly Shia, but Muslims all over the world, the Islamic Republic, which came into existence, was this beam of hope. And of course, if you look at how Iranians view the Islamic Republic today, the best image is this young girl lying on the streets of Tehran, bleeding to death, and the torture and the repression that followed. Thank you.
Prof. Salamu was, as usual, said, giving such a wide-ranging analysis of a situation. And I'd like to invite you, any one of you who would like to put some questions. I think we can afford 50 minutes of questions, because then we will follow the advice of our patron saint, Saint Paul, and have some wine. And so,
do you see any way out of the impasse created by these two realities that you very, very, very precisely pointed out? Can we hope that sometimes these two big religions could come closer and perhaps work for a better region, which is also has been always in conflict, as you actually explained? Thank you.
Yes, let me say a little bit about religion and peace building, religion and conflict resolution. That is also what Scott Appleby meant by talking about the ambivalence of the sacred. All religions, but particularly the Abrahamic religions, contain enormous resources for nonviolent conflict, for peace. And the question is how one mines them, how one brings them to the surface. And the ways in which they can be brought to the surface depends upon learned individuals in both of those traditions, looking into their own tradition and doing what my colleague, Professor Mark Gopin, who studied this far more than I have, calls a hermeneutic transformation of their own texts. That is, to go into the texts, not to question the texts, not to deny the texts, but since all texts are open to hermeneutics, to interpretation, to try and see whether or not there are bridges that can be built between the traditions. And there are. One of them is the sanctity of life in all of the traditions. In the Quran, you can find a shura, a chapter, which says something won't be alien to any of us in this room. To kill even one man is to kill all of humanity. The sanctity of life is very special. The sanctity of Jerusalem as a place of peace is very special. So what we have going on, and the newspapers don't cover it, and it's never published in foreign affairs or foreign policy, are people at the local level, imams and rabbis, who meet in prayer and who meet in discussion to try and create a construction of those two visions that will extrude violence from the discussion. And this is happening. No one much writes about it, but it's happening. One of the reasons why individuals don't much think about religion, professional peacemakers and diplomats don't much think about religion as a source of peace, is very simple. In fact, you have an example here in Malta, unfortunately, with the American ambassador. And the example is that most elites, most diplomats, most people in the State Department, most people trained in foreign policy are uncomfortable with religion. Even if they're personally people of faith, America has a very strong tradition of separation of church and state, they're uncomfortable with religion. And they're uncomfortable dealing with really religious people, people of faith. And so one of the things that happened in the Middle East, when peace accords are negotiated or signed, and this is true of both Palestinians and the Israelis and the Americans when they play a third party, is you always deal with the religious moderates. That's a very powerful word in diplomacy. Let's reach out to the moderates. And so the moderates are ones who mostly agree with you. And it's a little bit like the wonderful expression, preaching to the choir. So you bring the moderates in, and they sign the treaties, the accords. But the street, the people, don't give the moderates much legitimacy. They look to the truly orthodox, the ones who can issue the fatwas, the ones who could issue the rulings. And so one of the things you must do is you must engage, to use an American term, you must engage the most fundamentalist of the actors. Those are the ones that you have to reach. If you can reach them, then you can imagine dialogues which are conflictual but which extrude violence. Let me give one example of a resource for violence from Islam, partly because that religion gets, shall we say, much bad press. In the 1920s, in the Northwest Territories, what is today the cockpit of conflict between Afghanistan and Pakistan, there was a Pashtun religious leader, a Pashtun, the people that we connect with the worst violence, the worst jihad today, whose name was Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan. And he was known as the Frontier Gandhi. You can Google it. 1920s, the Frontier Gandhi. And he put together a social movement to protest British occupation that had over 100,000 Pashtuns and others in what is today that part of Pakistan, to protest the British occupation nonviolently. He was committed to nonviolence. He looked into the Quran, he looked into the Hadith, he looked into the Sharia, and he saw Islam as a powerful force for peace. 100,000. Why doesn't anyone know about him today? These resources are there, but they must be mined. Let me give one example of a powerful moment in religious reconciliation, which was not about text, it was about deeds. In 1997, a deranged Jordanian border guard shot across the border at Israeli children who were having a picnic and killed seven and wounded several. And of course, the country, Israel, was up in arms, was about to go to war over this. It was clear that the man was deranged. King Hussein, the father of the present king of Jordan, flew to Israel, came back from Europe, helicoptered into Israel, and visited the homes of the parents of the girls who were killed, and said, "I come before you as a father." And there's a Jewish mourning ritual called sitting Shiva, where you cover the mirrors and you sit on low stools and you fast. And he participated with them for a day. He reached out to a Jewish ritual of mourning and reached out as a father and reached out as a king. That completely diffused the crisis. Who could go to war with a country with that leader? And he did it not simply by apologizing, you know, the standard diplomatic thing, "We very much regret the loss of life." He did it by coming to the parents who were in grief and partaking in a ritual that was meaningful to them. That's true religious reconciliation. And it didn't mean he was no longer a good Muslim when he did it.
I would like to refer to part of our history. Once you've been here about 13 years ago, and you're here now, you must have heard as well about the fact that Malta was administered for about 270 years between 1530 and 1798 by a religious order, the Order of St. John, which was perhaps religious politics and political religion, both. And during that time, there were a lot of conflicts between the knights and the Maltese, conflicts between the knights and the bishop, conflicts between the knights and the inquisitor, and conflicts, obviously, with Islam, when the order itself showed a lot of violence. I wonder whether you've got any observations about this particular situation, this particular period of our history.
Not being a professional historian of Mediterranean history, I don't think there's any special insight, except to affirm what you said, is that it was a tremendously complex stew where they were both the political religion force in the country, but they were unable to extricate themselves from the religious politics of the church more generally, which was true in Christendom at that point of time anyway. The religious conflicts between the inquisitor, wherever the Inquisition was, and whoever was the Grand Inquisitor, and the local bishop or cardinals, and Rome, was a feature of Catholicism, of the church, during that period. And one could say that what held all of that together was the external foe. The fact that whatever fractures there were here, one could always look over the horizon and worry about one sultan or another sending a fleet over. So I think it was religious politics in a historical pressure cooker. But other than that, I have no tremendous insight into Maltese history, except that it's interesting, of course, that the Maltese themselves, the people, you, who were living here, also had your conflicts with the knights, because they were governing, and they were governing undoubtedly in the way people governed then, in an authoritarian manner, probably with not a little arrogance towards the Maltese people, the common people. I was actually afraid you were going to ask me something about Maltese politics today, which I feel much safer with the Great Siege than with the current siege that's being fought on billboards, I think. So thank you for being gentle.
Professor Busby.
A good part of your
very fascinating lecture concerned, in my view, primarily the Jewish, or rather the Israeli situation. Would you say that your analysis would apply, for example, to the problems between the Shiites and the Sunnis? Would it apply to the problems between Muslims and Hindus?
Well, it would certainly apply to problems between the Sunni and the Shia, because they have really very different notions of how the religion, of how Islam should be organized. The Sunni are essentially decentralized. They do not have a genealogical sense of leadership descending. The Shia do. The Shia itself, as you know, has devolved into different branches and different sects, all of which follow one hidden or occulted imam or another. So they have very, very different conceptions of what the social structure and the political structure of Islam should look like. So yes, those conflicts are political and structural and historical, and they are fairly deep. And your other question was between Muslims and Hindus. In the case of India, Hindus approach Muslims with the historical memory of the Muslim conquest, the Mughal conquest. And Hindus approach Muslims with the historical memory of what some have called a chosen trauma, and that's the trauma of conquest, the trauma of the destruction of Hindu temples and the creation of mosques and so forth for centuries and centuries. So Hindus approach Muslims as people who once conquered us and who denigrated our religion, and who split India. The partition of 1946 was a tremendous wound. And so even those Hindus who are much more tolerant, and many Muslims are, and many Hindus are, about their Muslim brethren, feel that they were betrayed when Gandhi and Nehru reached out and said, "We are all Indian, this is all Mother India." And Muslims under Jinnah, under Iqbal, rejected that and said, "No, we don't trust you. We want our own country." So the wounds there are both old. They go back to the Mughal conquest, to the 9th century and the 10th century, and they're also recent. They go back to the area of decolonization, really to the same time that Israel goes back to, 46 in the case of India, 48 in the case of Israel. And of course, there were many, many, many hundreds of thousands of deaths during the partition, so that families can, on both sides, can reach not very far back into their own family histories to find themselves victimizers or victims in that terrible split.
I think that conflicts that are born of religious background, shall I say, are sometimes a question of religious freedom. If I'm not mistaken, Vatican II would give a certain definition of religious freedom. Let us say the exclusion of all coercion in matters religious. I wonder if you could enlarge on that, unless I'm encroaching on the 15th minute, of course.
Well, I'm not sure that I understand your question entirely. It is certainly the case that because of the importance of where I started, the social psychological importance of religion to the constitution of self, of personhood. Of course, when religion is repressed by a hostile regime, then the struggle for religious freedom itself becomes a core conflict. Itself becomes a struggle that might induce violence. So in that sense, yes, the struggle for freedom of religion could well be a situation of tremendous conflict and tremendous violence. But the other part of your remark, I think, was about the freedom to practice religion, and that once religion can be freely practiced in a society, and once there is no coercion in religion, then perhaps some of the sources of religious conflict could be removed. And if that was the thrust of your question, then I can only agree. And once again, even the religion that is sometimes most demonized today in terms of conflict, partly because it is the most coherent religion today with respect to claims of political religion, and that is Islam, the Quran is quite clear in the Shura that says, there shall be no compulsion in religion. That religion's conversion to Islam should not be done by the sword. Now, as many religious dicta, it is sometimes more obeyed in the text than in history. But Islam itself is very, very clear on that.
I'd like to thank Professor Abu for this very nice lecture. I'd like to thank you for being present tonight. And I'd like you to know that the Tahrir chapter, owns this building now, will be organizing these lectures on a regular basis, especially in the coming year. So I invite you for future lectures, will be notified in the normal means, and I'm sure you'll enjoy them. I'd like to thank His Grace the Archbishop and His Excellency for coming and joining us, and all of you, and I'd like also to thank finally the Shahra Palace, the management of the Shahra Palace, who has offered us the drink tonight. Thank you very much for your time.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the CERN entitled Religion, Conflict and Violence in Contemporary and Historical Perspective. This talk was delivered by Professor Kevin Avruk.